Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 1087.1K1210, certificate number 41003, Porfirio Rubirosa.
His legend precedes him the way lightning precedes thunder. He is the most interesting man in the world.
Porfirio Rubirosa.
Very nice.
I'm not sure.
Is that your Zorro tryout
reel?
I'm
not sure if it's very good, but there. I can't say something like that without doing it like Antonio Banderas.
You don't just want to sit there and be like, Rubirosa. No,
Porfirio Rubirosa.
I always think of, what is that from? Oh, Richard Widmark in the old Murder on the Orient Express never tries to say Poirot's name right. He's just always like, Mr. Perot. Like he's talking to Ross Perot. Mr. Perot, I need you to guard my train.
I kind of like that.
Do you want to turn into a white guy that doesn't try to say foreign names?
No,
right?
I definitely want to be the opposite of that.
I know. Do you remember last year when Quincy Jones, music legend Quincy Jones, started giving those just weird interviews to everybody?
Yeah, super crazy takedown interviews where he was like, Michael Jackson was a fraud.
He said things like, I know who killed Kennedy. Uh-huh. He said, I was there when Marlon Brando had sex with Richard Pryor. He talked about how the Beatles were...
I need to go back and read these interviews more closely.
Now you're like, I'm intrigued.
I am. He's sort of a role model for me.
Well, he said the Beatles were all bad musicians.
So right, I remember that.
That might be a deal killer for you.
No, I mean, there are differing opinions on that. I think he's very super duper wrong, but he's Quincy Jones. He's entitled to.
I know exactly.
To feel
and,
that
and
way.
He knows it. You're Quincy Jones. You're 80. The governor's off the mouth.
Right.
You can say whatever, and you've got stories
and
for
it,
sure.
In particular, I mean, there are all kinds of. If you go on the guitar player forums, there are so many people that are like, Kurt Cobain was a terrible musician. It's like, yeah, okay, you know, Steve Vai is a good musician, but. Who would you rather like? I mean, and actually, who would you rather spend a weekend with? Absolutely, Steve Vai. But
well, especially today.
True.
is that too dark?
Ouch.
Unless you're Pete Townsend leaving those comments, I think you should leave well enough alone. You know.
Yeah.
You know, one name that dropped in those interviews that probably did not make the headlines was the man that Quincy Jones remembered as the King of the Playboys. He remembered his time spent nightclub hopping with Don Porfirio Rubirosa.
He's the world's most interesting man.
He is, in effect, the most interesting man in the world. If there's ever been a real-life analog of the kind of suave Latino guy we've seen in commercials who has seen and done everything, it would be the mid-20th century playboy man about town, Porfirio Rubirosa.
Sounds like my kind of guy.
I think you guys might have a lot in common.
Mm-hmm.
Quincy Jones remembered him in the interview. This is the 8-word summary he gives in the interview. Amazing man. What a guy. 11-inch.
Well, it's about time we did a show like this.
I don't want to be too delicate because I know the futurelings may be ethereal beings.
Sure, they may be sentient.
my guess is they would have little patience for our obsession with like fleshly matters like this. They're a higher sort.
I see what you're saying.
And perhaps they're listening with their ethereal, wispy children.
Sure.
And they're going to have to cover their ear gases.
Right. But we're famously a show that doesn't do very many swears, but we do talk about matters of the flesh.
Well, when they're unavoidably attached to history, as they so often are.
Right. And I mean,
it's really hard to divorce, you know, mankind's three or four primal urges. Humankind, why not?
Sure.
From all the wars and treaties and social movements and trends that followed, right?
I feel like our ethereal like progeny they probably laugh at all of our endeavors because all we do is make war and rut, and every once in a while somebody, you know, writes a good melody.
I mean, they probably just think of Porfirio Rubirosa the way we do when we the way we snicker when we hear some scientist theory about how dinosaurs did it, right?
Oh, how they did it.
Yeah. You know, like...
What I'm going to love about this episode most is hearing all of your Mormon euphemisms for sex.
I'm pretty sure we did not invent did it.
No,
but... Nobody ever said doing it before the Mormons were like...
But I haven't heard it in a long time.
We can't say pork. We can't say boink.
See?
What?
Here they come.
These are from 80s teen comedies. These are not from Sunday school, John. I hate to break this to you.
Doing it.
Well, Quincy Jones's memories of Porfirio appear to be, they were no secret at the time, I guess. Like his fantastic physical attributes were well known at the time.
Like Milton Berle.
Exactly.
Famously endowed.
Yeah, and didn't mind showing it off. Pretty much all the depraved things that middle America thought were happening in the entertainment industry were actually happening.
Isn't that the amazing part?
Isn't that funny? During this time when everybody else was going to church and had to you know, you couldn't say a piano had legs because that would be too, you had to say stilts or something. Like people on the coast, Milton Berle really was just unzipping at Sardi's.
Yeah.
And showing everybody.
You know, my mom, when I talked, because she was a contemporary of that whole time. And when I talked to her about the Rat Pack and that Vegas scene and the show business at the time, she says, like, nice people didn't like that music. That was that culture that now seems to stand in for
the early 60s.
She's like, those were gangsters, and that was gangster culture. And if you liked it, it was low brow.
That's
and
so funny.
It plays now as this like suave.
Sinatra was pretty much
Scooby Dooby Doo.
Is that even true once Kennedy's in the White House and like all these people are effectively, American diplomats?
Yeah, it was really, I mean, as far as she was concerned, it was a déclassé culture and Kennedy was slumming for reasons of his own. But she was like, all of them, you know, even Sammy Davis, she was like, he's a gangster. They're performing for gangsters. It's gangster money and it's gangster music, which, you know, obviously has a little bit of like anti-Italian overtones to her ideas, right? Or her cultural ideas.
Look, if the Italians want us to make us stop telling gangster jokes, I need to stop hearing the Godfather theme every time I go into a pizzeria. You know? Like, if every time I go someplace to eat tortellini, I'm going to hear... then the Italian Anti-Defamation League cannot say a thing.
It's funny, though, when she describes growing up in Ohio in the 30s, she said, you know, there were no black people in her part of Ohio, Western Ohio, and there were no Jews, so all of our racism was directed at Catholics. And I was like, right, Catholics.
It must have been such a relief when Sammy Davis first appeared on the scene.
I was like,
so she finally could broaden her scope.
Well, no, you know, she was liberally minded, but yeah, interesting to think that there was, even in the late 60s, there still would have been an intact Italian or Latin culture.
Oh, I don't know if Rubirosa was intact.
Ooh.
Sorry, I'm just kidding.
Oh, boy.
History does not relate.
Kicks to the spleen, these remarks.
Rubirosa did hang out with Sinatra and these Rat Pack guys. He apparently taught Sammy Davis how to kiss a woman's hand in his patented Latin manner.
Was he an aristocrat?
Kind of. Let's get into his origin story. Sinatra, the story about Sinatra is Sinatra asking him, Ruby, everybody called him Ruby, don't you have a job? Like, what do you do for a living? And he said, you know, women are my living.
Women.
Right. He considered romancing the best and the brightest of the Western Hemisphere his full-time job. Hmm. Quincy Jones's memories of his anatomy are backed up by Truman Capote, of all people, in his memoirs. Hmm. And his nickname in Paris apparently was toujours prêt, always ready. It's the motto of the Coast Guard. you can interpret that as literally as you want, but he was good to go.
Uh-huh.
under any circumstances.
Women are my living.
And the list of the women pretty much is, you know, the list you would make in your head. Ava Gardner, Jane Mansfield, Veronica Lake, Marilyn Monroe, Rita Hayworth, Joan Crawford, Judy Garland. If there was
any, Judy Garland?
I just watched the Judy biopic, and it's all about her last marriage to this kind of 28-year-old sketchy entrepreneur guy. But the funny thing is, the movie's very shy about it. Like, huh. it really doesn't want us to imagine an older woman and a younger man, even now, in after 50 years of movies of, you know, 70-year-old men with Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Right.
Like, it really thinks we're going to be a little squeamish if Renee Zellweger and Finn Wittrock are a little too passionate in their hotel room. Anyway, yeah, Judy Garland had no problem with a younger trade, a younger classic guy.
Mm-hmm.
And Ruby was just apparently a genius. You know, Zsa Zsa Gabor would come back and find her hotel suite just filled with flowers and a note that said, you are the most beautiful woman in the world. You know, signed Don Porfirio Rubirosa, Minister Plenipotentiary of the Dominican Republic.
Oh, so he was a Dominican diplomat?
He was. He was a macho. He kind of created the macho archetype of the suave Latin man that has persisted to this day.
Did he talk like Antonio Banderas? Are we going to do his voice as Antonio Banderas?
I am
the whole
absolutely going to do. I was kind of doing Ricardo Montalban.
Yeah, okay, that's a good one.
But I'm going to absolutely say yes.
Okay.
He did. Are we okay with that?
Yeah, I'm fine.
He was apparently not like the hottest young guy on the dance floor, but he was just very gallant. You know, always had one red rose. You know, would dance with the same woman all night, just looking into her eyes like she was the entire universe.
Right.
And, you know, he just had the knack. And, you know, as his, he was not lying on his business cards. He was a diplomat by career, but it was really just a way to hang out in Paris. He didn't actually do any diplomacy, it turns out.
So how did he rise to this station? Is this a story where he was born in rags and this is all a sham, or does he come from Spanish line of very important people?
He was middle class in the Dominican Republic, and his line to power goes through Rafael Trujillo, the feared and fearsome dictator of the Dominican Republic from the 30s all the way into the early 60s. Probably one of the worst people on the planet at the time.
Right.
And we'll get into that a little later.
But that was
his entree into European society.
It's amazing how much a dictator can level a class system and just sort of...
Oh, you were the guy that didn't pick up the phone during the coup? Hey, you're my new minister to Berlin. Congratulations. No, that is absolutely what happened with kind of a sexual overtone that we will see in a moment.
I can't wait.
He, as you would not be surprised to hear, Ruby kind of slept his way to the bottom, then the middle, then the top.
Was he bisexual?
I don't think there's any evidence of that. Although, you know, we're recording this the same week that Scotty Bowers died, kind of the legendary Hollywood, I don't even know what this job is called. I don't want to say pimp.
Fluffer?
The guy you would call if you were Spencer Tracy and Cary Grant and wanted everyone to think you were straight, but wanted to meet nice, discreet young men.
Oh, I see.
But
you don't want to say pimp.
No, because he was a...
Procurer.
He was putting people together.
Concierge.
What do you call somebody who makes relationships like that? He was a maven, a mentor.
A yenta.
Yes, exactly. He was a West Hollywood yenta. That's exactly right. And not strictly for the gay scene, although those are all the most scandalous stuff in the memoirs. So, you know, at this time, all the most, you know, dapper masculine men on the planet had no problem, you know, you know, experimenting on the side, apparently. Middle America was right about that, too. It wasn't just Marlon Brando and James Baldwin and Richard Pryor in a threesome or whatever. But most of his attention appeared to be on the ladies. After a brief falling out with Trujillo, he wound up kind of stuck in Paris with no source of income. And that's when he can't go home.
The worst thing about being a playboy is to end up somewhere with no source of income.
It really appears to have been very formative for him because it really shapes what he spends the next decade of his life doing. But during the period kind of around the beginning of World War II, because he had no source of income, he would sell Dominican visas to Jews trying to get out of Europe.
Oh.
So he's like, basically, what if Oskar Schindler just wanted to drink and play polo all day,
Right. So there was a profit motive. He found a market that was like not being exploited.
Right.
And he
wasn't fussy about whose visas he stamped.
And did that result in a Jewish community in the Dominican Republic? It must
have. I assume that was just a stopping over point.
On their way
and they
somewhere.
Were all in Miami by the end of the week
or
Havana or something. I don't know. It would be interesting if there's still some lively synagogue in Santo Domingo from the early Trujillo era, but I don't think so.
Or to trace some expatriate population that remained somewhat intact.
Yeah.
They all came through this one fixer.
Ruby Rosa's list.
Yeah.
imagine all these kind of like, all these, elderly Jewish folks and their multi-generational descendants standing in front of some, grave at Père Lachaise with a picture of a Ferrari on it.
So he fell out of favor, but he still had access. He still had enough diplomatic access that he had a prescription pad for Dominican visas.
Yeah, he was still working in the embassy, but Trujillo was angry at him and he couldn't come home. And he was just unscrupulous. At one point he found a Spaniard who had fled the Civil War who wanted to get out. But the guy wanted to make sure he brought with him. It was a jeweler. The Spaniard wanted to make sure his jewels came with him. And so Ruby Rosa Porfirio said, I'll go to Madrid and check it out. And he comes back and says, yeah, sorry, your store was ransacked. I got shot out. The jewels are all gone. The jeweler's like, really? They were all safely there. You got shot at? Your car seems fine. Yeah, see, amigo, what are you going to do? He just ransacked the guy's shop and took hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of jewels.
A burglar.
To finance. Yes, he's a burglar. During the war, he marries, in fact, France's biggest movie star. This is kind of his social climbing begins. Danielle Darrieux. She was a Nazi sympathizer.
Okay.
It turned out she was super excited about the invasion.
Sure.
As a result, she was a contract, like Maurice Chevalier and all these other people that agreed to perform for the occupiers during the war.
They played Sun City.
Yes, exactly. They played Le Cité du Soleil. So they had to get out of Paris for all. And he spent most of the war as a gentleman farmer on Danielle Darrieux's estate outside of Paris. But he liked the idle life. And when the war ended, he decided he wanted as much of that as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't you?
Pretty formative experience, right? Laying around in a collaborational movie star's house.
So after the affair with Darrieux goes wrong.
Collaborational. What am I talking about? Go ahead.
I'm sure that's the word.
Okay.
All these collaborationalists with their collaborationalistism. After the war, he doesn't seem to stay with these women for that long. The appeal of him as a lover apparently palls at some point.
Sure. I mean, not to reveal too much knowledge, but if we are going with the measurement here of an 11-inch member, as we say,
endowment,
I feel like that seems impressive. Like at first blush, like wow, holy simoleons!
But that famous expression.
But I bet it gets kind of tiresome pretty fast because that would be abnormally large. It would not be probably like especially useful.
Yeah, at some point the novelty must pall.
Yeah,
I can only imagine.
It's a novelty rather than a rather than a practical instrument.
When we bought our house, our house has kind of a lovely view of the Cascade Mountains, as many homes in the Seattle area do. And I just thought, wow, I will just stare at this all day. Like, this is like nothing I've ever seen before. What a delight this will be in my life to have this beautiful mountain panorama. But guess what? Every time you open the curtains, it looks exactly the same. And eventually, it's just not as exciting as it was the first time. It really just kind of blends into the background. This is part of the house. There's mountains outside it.
Your brilliant million-dollar view of the mountains is the 11-inch of this analogy?
It's the 11-inch of the listing, certainly.
I see.
That's what I put in the listing.
Oh, of course. Right? If you're going to sell the house, it's the first thing you say about it.
Right.
But
you don't want to tell the people, you know, it's just...
Right.
You're not going to sit and stare because it looks the same every night.
Did you get the sense that Rubirosa left all of his paramours happy, or did he was there bitterness in his trail?
There appears to be a little bit of both. He apparently hit Zsa Zsa Gabor. Like, she would show up with a eye patch or dark glasses or something. So, you know, he's the fiery, awful misogynist of his time. And yet she spoke very fondly of him. Like, everybody remembers their time with him very well. But here's what's remarkable about his womanizing in the late 40s to early 50s. He marries in a row the two richest women in the world. To either billionaires or future billionaires.
Sure.
I hate to gender billionaires.
I think billionaire is what we'll go with, but billionaires is a nice coinage.
In 1947, he married Doris Duke.
Sure.
The heir to the Duke tobacco fortune.
Right.
Duke University, to this day, bears the name of the Lucky Strike fortune.
And she was, at the time, the richest woman in the world?
She was. Walmart,
the Walmart daughter.
Right, before Sam Walton split all his money and made eight women the 1 through 8 richest people on the planet. apparently at the time that Doris Duke died in 1993, there were only two photos by her bedside, and one of them was Porfiria Rubirosa.
Wow.
Like, she still had fond memories of her years with Ruby.
And the other one was Bert from Sesame Street.
It was so weird. Bert, why did you never love me? I don't know. Is she from the Carolinas?
Must have been.
So they spent most of their years together. He was posted to Argentina. But he goes to Argentina to see, you know, what's up with the center-right dictatorship there. And of course, ends up sleeping with Eva Perón the whole time. So he doesn't seem like a great guy to be married to.
He's a real gump.
Doris Duke, you know, kind of a pretty society girl at the time, but, you know, it was commented on at the time that he was marrying kind of a, you know, she wasn't Ava Gardner or Rita Hayworth, you know,
right.
Like, but he was just delighted that she had $1 billion. And,
And there's no place more like mid-century glamorous than Buenos Aires.
Sure.
I mean, glamorous in a way that, It's still pretty mid-century glamorous.
Sure,
now.
The wide boulevards, and he was not in love with it, you know, despite the attractions of Evita. He would just spend as much time in, he'd get posted to Havana or Buenos Aires or wherever, he would just spend as much time as he could in Paris, where he knew all the nightclubs and he knew everybody. The marriage to Doris only lasted a few years. She made him sign a prenup, but even once they split up, he got all the stuff. He got the polo ponies and the Peloponnese and the 3-story home in Paris,
like,
and the cars,
right,
and the planes and whatnot. So she must have had some fond memories.
Sure. She kicked him down 2% of the interest payments on her property.
In 1953, he married the second richest woman in the world, Barbara Hutton. Has she come up on the other four? Heir to the Woolworth fortune.
Yeah.
And, famously, we should do a show on these poor little rich girls of the mid-20th century.
Yeah, my great uncle married the heiress of the Buster Brown shoe fortune in the 1920s, 1930s, and lived in a giant house in Connecticut on the water that was like the Buster Brown house.
And the house that Buster built.
And he sat there in a giant chair as though he had made all that money and sent really really preachy letters to my grandmother telling her she was screwing up.
Barbara Hutton had been a beautiful woman. She was married to Cary Grant, but she was now, I think, in her 40s. And,
oh, well, that's a death knell.
Well, she'd been, yeah. So game over.
In her 40s.
Well, she had already been married to Cary Grant and three European noblemen named Igor or something.
As was the style at the time.
Sure, as you would expect. So yeah. She flitted from husband to husband. She was kind of the sadder but wiser girl at this point. I guess she had such a great time dancing, et cetera, with him that she just said, you married Doris, now it's my turn.
Oh, wow.
She was happy to inherit him. And at this, her fifth wedding, she wore a black wedding dress. Got married at the Dominican embassy. She was holding a scotch and soda as she walked down the aisle.
Damn.
Which to me is the ultimate
come on
power move.
This girl is fire.
And, you know, this marriage really didn't last any longer, but it was the same kind of a thing where, you know, he inherited yet another airplane from her. He winds up with two B-25 bombers.
That's genius.
One from each marriage.
That's genius. That have been kitted out as like limousines.
Have you never thought of just marrying a woman for her B-25?
The number of heiresses who have B-25s is a lot lower now than it was in 1952, I'm betting.
You have to wait for the first crop of Seattle billionaires to have poor little rich girl daughters.
If Paul Allen had had any children, mm-hmm. They would have plenty of World War II vintage aircraft at their disposal, but he unfortunately died without siring.
Oh,
anyone.
Speaking of which, Ruby was sterile as well, which was another big perk.
Really?
In the pre-birth control era, yes.
How was that determined? Just
It was by me reading an article about it. Is that what you mean?
No, I mean, I guess I always assume in a period like that, that someone's sterility would be established by them attempting to have children with their spouse over the course of many years, mm-hmm. and then going into the doctor and saying, what's wrong with me? Whereas someone who's just playboy gallivanting from place to place.
He has no idea how many, the trail of abortions he's leaving in his wake before he's elected the 45th president of the United States.
And it never occurs to him to like go to the doctor and go, you know, I should have gotten at least one of these girls pregnant.
It may have been knowledge from his first marriage, which we'll get to in a moment, which I've kind of glided over for dramatic purposes. But it may have also just been literally the thousands of women that he was sleeping with. He figured it out.
Huh, interesting.
Maybe it was a Hemingway-esque war injury. Should we imagine that?
Yeah, let's say, well, I don't know. He doesn't sound like he experienced any war injuries.
He did experience very little war, but he was an adventurer. Harold Robbins based a kind of a Latin adventurer Lothario character on him. And apparently there's a school of thought that he may have been a very close inspiration for James Bond.
Really?
Ian Fleming's Caribbean connection, you know, spending all his time on Jamaica, right? Was GoldenEye on Jamaica?
Yeah, I think so.
It meant he hung out with all these people who would have been in Ruby's circle, Errol Flynn and Noel Coward. And Ruby was very much a Bondian figure, you know, hanging out. You know, he would get up every day and play polo, his real passion in the morning. But then as soon as polo was over, it was just scotch for the rest of the day. And gambling.
Was there any sense that he was in espionage? Did he do, like, was there tradecraft in his story?
There is going to be the hint of tradecraft coming up.
Exciting.
But I don't know if that's what would have inspired. Those rumors were out there, so that may have inspired Fleming.
But we're talking about like white flannel adventuring. We're not talking about, he didn't go into the jungle and discover a new kind of butterfly.
He searched for sunken treasure in the Caribbean.
All right.
In 1952. He had the two B-52 bomber, or B-25 bombers, obviously. Right. I'm dyslexic about these bombers.
Right.
Which he could pilot. He turned adventuring at home, but he turned the third floor of the house he had inherited from Doris Duke. He got rid of the servants' quarters and put in a full bar and a boxing ring. Uh-huh. So he could just have boxing matches at night after Jimmy's Disco closed.
That does seem pretty continental.
He raced Ferraris at Le Mans twice. He was on the 24-hour race at Le Mans twice. So he was a fast and dangerous driver, which will also play into his story. So I think Fleming is maybe responding more to his just glamorous, womanizing, devil-may-care lifestyle than anything else.
Do you, in following a story like this and meeting someone like Porfirio?
Don Porfirio.
Does it cause you to question your own life and how few times you've been to Paris and how how little of this kind of wanton adventure you've had? Because I've never played polo in the morning once, not a single time.
I just feel like I would be a bad fit for the idleness of it.
For the hanging out with no clear purpose.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I have fond memories of doing that in college, mm-hmm. you know, just long nights of Risk or Mario Kart or pizza or whatever, and just shooting the bull with nobody.
You've got to get up and do some work.
Right. Like, and I guess he did have a schedule, polo, then scotch. And then he would say around in the mid-afternoon, he would start to feel what he called the petit cochon, the little pig in his brain would start to wake up and
going, going, going. Sure.
Women, you know, like he would start to feel the urge drawing him to the nightlife. But I just feel like I feel guilty. I feel kind of guilty when I go to a movie during the day. Yeah. I feel like that's the closest to Don Draper I ever get, you know? Like, but do you think you could do it?
To be an international playboy?
Like you sit in bathtubs a lot.
Yeah, I think I would be pretty good at it. You know, I've always felt like my dad acted like he was the scion of a wealthy and fallen sort of family of former aristocrats whose name was, you know, still the name still was the passport, although there wasn't any money behind it. By the time that mentality got to me, I no longer even felt like the name had any cachet, but I still, you know, I walk into a room and assume always that I'm welcome. And
I have friends that comment on this. Like, it's the first thing they notice about you.
That I seem,
in any room, you're just like, hey.
And that, so I've always felt like I belonged in this somewhat, this life, but I also believe that if I had access to it, I would have been a bad person. And I don't, you know, we could look at Porfirio and judge whether or not we think he's a good person, but I feel like there, it would have made my heart a different thing. If I had had the wealth to go through life with no consequences.
Think about those stories John Mulaney tells about watching Mick Jagger at SNL and how he's just a guy who for 50 years has been able to say Diet Coke and a Diet Coke appears in his hand.
He just says it to the room. Yeah. He doesn't direct it to anyone.
And a Diet Coke will just appear and he knows that will happen. Imagine what that would do to your soul.
I heard a story about Keith Richards that he was at somebody's, you know, see, he was invited to someone's beautiful home in somewhere in the Carolinas for whatever reason. I don't remember what it was. And he just he was walking through the house like, yeah, it's a nice, nice house. And took a drag of his cigarette and just threw it on the carpet and kept walking.
Because he knows, no. At first it was just like, nobody will tell me no. And then at some point it's just like, he doesn't even think anymore. No one has ever told me no. Like it doesn't even matter. Yeah, it's just the corrosive effect of money and cocooning like that, I guess.
Yeah. So let's hear. I want to hear his fall here.
Well,
so
I was thinking if I was an international playboy, I would be the kind that's using it as cover.
Yeah. Well, that's the way
I'd be super busy being Bruce Wayne.
If you were up to something, right? If you were carrying diplomatic pouches or you were working on behalf of a shadowy agency, then.
If I'm repatriating stolen antiquities at the time.
Yeah, exactly. You can do all this James Bond stuff and feel like you're doing good in the world, but it's not really.
I need to have sex with Ava Gardner. I'm sorry.
Sorry, look.
I don't want this.
I had to establish my cover.
I had to do it. I felt bad about it. And that there's some suggestion that this may have been true of Ruby Rosa as well. His connection with Trujillo. So Trujillo took power in around 1930. Some ineffectual Dominican president got pushed out of the way for Trujillo, who had been trained by U.S. Marines. Ironically,
sure, that's how it works.
We don't usually have too many scruples about that kind of thing.
No,
he didn't seem like a Marxist, so yeah, let him do whatever he wants. And he was awful. He was a Caesar of the Caribbean. And Trujillo was his, and he chose Ruby Rosa as a protege, just kind of picked him out of the military. And what soured their relationship briefly was that Ruby Rosso just was unable to control himself and wound up in an affair with Trujillo's daughter, Flor de Oro.
Oh!
Flower of golden flower. And so for a while, Trujillo, this was some unforgivable thing. Trujillo was going to have the guy killed. And, you know, finally, maybe Flor throws herself at her father's feet.
No, Papa!
Papa, I love him! They all speak English with...
Of course. Of course they do. Comical, to one another.
Comical Latino accents. And he ends up kind of reconciling with...
Trujillo.
Sends him to... Well, he sends the couple to I guess Hitler's Berlin is their first posting. And from there, Paris, which, you know, where Ruby Rosa is like a cachon in Merde. But Trujillo kind of comes around on him. At one point, Trujillo visits Paris... And Ruby shows him a good time, takes him to the Eiffel Tower. He apparently like beds some woman in somewhere in the restaurant of the Eiffel Tower or something. And Trujillo's like, "Oh, you're not wrong. Paris is great." And he decides that Ruby Rosa is his guy. He says he's an excellent diplomat because women like him and because he's a liar. And the other thing that saves him is his friendship with Trujillo's son and eventual successor, Ramfis Trujillo, who... If it's possible to be more of a psychopath than his father, it's always true, right? If you're raised by somebody like Keith Richards or Rafael Trujillo or Donald Trump or whatever, like, you know, you're just going to be a bad clone of it, right?
A bad clone. It just, you hope that, that the sociopath passes on his worst genes. Like in the case of the Trump sons, you get the feeling that that their combined intelligence, you know, wouldn't allow them to get out of a puzzle room.
Yeah, they're like the fifth generation Michael Keatons from Multiplicity. Like the copy's just getting worse and worse. But Ramfis Trujillo was legitimately terrible. Like the FBI file on him or CIA file on him says that as a kid he would just cut off chickens' heads shoot guns at chickens' heads for fun.
Right.
You know, just decapitate chickens with a revolver.
Yeah, typical.
Just straight up serial killer stuff. Yeah. And so, like, by the time of adolescence, you know, he's just gang raping everything as far as the eye can see. And then later, when he's given some power, even worse, if that's possible, he kind of heads up all the torture and murder that follows the unsuccessful 59 uprising against his dad. And then once Trujillo falls out of favor and is eventually killed in 61, you know, he again tortures and murders just literally thousands of people to try to consolidate power. So he's awful, but he's also a playboy. He's also flying around the world, betting Kim Novak and driving fast cars. And so he and Ruby become fast friends. And that's kind of what saves Ruby Rosa with Trujillo after the marriage to Flor ends and he starts marrying movie stars and heiresses.
Oh, so he didn't lose, somehow Flora, stayed on his, or he stayed on her good side, or because he was friends with her brother, it didn't matter whether she was happy or not.
I think both. I think she, I guess everybody forgives this guy, which is one of the weirdest things about his story.
He's a liar.
Women love him and he's a liar. The thing about the Trujillo regime is that they were not shy about committing crimes and atrocities, not just on the island of Hispaniola. You know, they would love to just, you know, killing 10,000 Haitians was nothing to them, but they would also do crimes on foreign soil. Trujillo tried to kill the president of Venezuela at one point. Mm-hmm. The most famous case in 1956, there was a Basque international law professor named Jesus Galindez who had written extensively on Trujillo's crimes and atrocities. And he just disappeared from a subway station at 57th Street in New York while he was teaching at Columbia.
Whoa.
Trujillo just had a guy disappeared from Midtown, basically.
Huh. The Jimmy Hoffa story all over again.
Basically, except he's sending foreign agents to do it. And Ruby was always rumored in the tabloids to have connections to these awful exploits. The tabloids said two things about him. One, because he was always described as Nut Brown. He's a dusky Creole type from the racially indeterminate Caribbean. They said one of the worst things you could say about an upper-class person at the time, which is, what if he's black?
Sure, brown.
Right. They would have said colored or Negro, but right. You know, the implication would have been...
Mixed.
Ladies, you think this guy's suave, but what if instead of the best thing, sex with a Spanish man, it's the scariest thing to white people. What if it's a black guy? You know, so there would be a lot of these headlines. But the other scandalous ones were his connection to Trujillo's international regime of murder, which is, to me, on a whole different level. In 1935, a Trujillo enemy named Sergio Bencosme was killed in New York, and Ruby's cousin was fingered as the guy.
Huh.
And it was always suspected that Ruby Rosa had a connection to that killing and then subsequent other acts of violence for the regime as he traveled around the world, racing fast cars, flying bombers, getting nearly shipwrecked in the Caribbean looking for gold treasure. As he's having all these adventures, like, what if he's also enforcing the iron will of his former father-in-law?
Did he use his wealth to lift the rest of his family up in their station? Or was he someone that was always going from a rich woman's bed to rich woman's bed as a way, because he didn't actually maintain any money of his own? Did he try to establish a dynasty, or did he just spend every nickel?
Well, his family was, you know, upper middle class military types who were on the right side of the Trujillo uprising. Mm-hmm. So I think his family was okay, but to answer your question, he was not great with money. In 1961, or I believe, a coup removed Trujillo from power, and you know, Ruby, because of his connections to the Rat Pack and Peter Lawford, and by extension the Kennedys, was immediately dispatched to Hyannisport to get on a yacht and to try to get diplomatic recognition for Trujillo's son and to lift the embargo that the U.S. and the Organization of American States had put in place after the attempt on the president of Venezuela.
Huh.
So he was really supposed to work Kennedy's ear.
And so this is like some high-level diplomatic intrigue.
Yes. And I think, as I understand it, Ruby could have got it done. But he got back to Santo Domingo only to find that Ramfis Trujillo, who instead of consolidating power in his dad's wake, had realized how much the citizens of the Dominican Republic hated the Trujillos and had just absconded to Spain with $200 million.
Oh, wow.
So Ruby thought he could get it done, but that effectively ends his political career right then. And,
sure.
And this is a guy with what Oleg Cassini estimated to be a $2 million a year lifestyle. $2 million, $1961, I assume.
Right.
Jetting between Saint-Tropez and Deauville and Palm Beach and Gestad. And, you know, this guy lived it up.
So he has no home base now and presumably no money?
He kept the place in Paris, but yeah, this is a guy with no income. And there's some consideration of doing what he does and maybe marrying Peter Lawford's ex or some other beautiful heiress from his circles. But for whatever reason, he never does it. He kind of has to downscale and he lives the early 60s not in the status to which he had become accustomed.
Huh.
He tries to sell perfume at one point with his Ruby perfume. You'll be a hit with the ladies, or cologne, I guess.
Yeah.
And at one point he markets Pego Palo, an aphrodisiac. Supposedly, you know, you take a few drops from your vial of Pego Palo.
Sure.
Which I think are two words meaning wooden stick, maybe. So it's not a subtle reference, but it's from some kind of Dominican herbs and tree bark that will give you the potency of Porfirio Ruby Rosa.
Right.
Rich Corinthian Viagra.
It's a Spanish fly.
Yeah, exactly. Going back to the Spanish fly episode. So, so that's what he's reduced to in the early 60s. And historians, sadly, in 1965, his polo team wins the Coupe de France, a big polo cup. That's not sad.
No. Seems like a little bit of a comeback.
But it's by far the best thing that happens that day. Because he and his set are partying the night away at Jimmy's, his favorite disco in Paris. And at 8 a.m., they switch to a different club to get ham sandwiches. I guess Jimmy's doesn't have the ham sandwiches they like.
Sure. Jamón.
And heading back to Jimmy's after his jamón, his late snack, around 8 a.m., his Ferrari jumps a curb in the Bois de Bologna, and Ruby plows right into one of the huge horse chestnut trees.
Ooh.
In Western Paris. And it's a race car with a wooden steering wheel, and it just plows right into his midsection. He gets essentially, you know, cut in half by a wooden steering wheel.
Blech.
And, you know, and actually Ramphus Trujillo died in a similar fiery car crash, I think maybe just a couple years later, around the same time. So his life ends in exactly the manner you'd expect, behind the wheel of a Ferrari between nightclubs.
Right.
No Grace Kelly type at his side, I guess. But thus ends the sad story of...
die young and leave a somewhat beautiful corpse.
People still remember, though, you know. Apparently, if you go to any of these kind of old school restaurants in New York City or Paris, where there's enough institutional memory for the time when this guy was the king of the Playboys, the most interesting man in the world, the original Latin lover, the creator of Macho, married to the two richest women in the world. Any place that'll have memory of that, if you want pepper ground on your salad and they bring out the big wooden, thick, foot-long pepper grinder to your table, they will call it the Ruby Rosa.
And that concludes Porfirio Rubirosa, entry 1087.1K1210, certificate number 41003 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram are archived at Omnibus Project. Our handles were at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick. If in the future you want your salad salted, just ask for a Roderico.
Is that pepper grinder bigger or smaller? No,
it's a salt grinder.
Oh, it's the salt grinder.
It's not like this big footlong thing.
Just a, nobody wants that.
But it is. It's not just like a salt shaker either. It's a, you know, it's a.
It's a respectable salt implement. Grinder.
It's like a thing that normal sized.
El Roderico. Thing.
El Roderico.
Give me the normal sized salt shaker, waiter.
I also am on Instagram at John Roderick. You can email us with all of your show ideas and ribald stories of your own prowess, your own great uncles.
Your own factual corrections, probably.
Who married heiresses.
I would love to hear that.
Yeah.
If your uncles married heiri.
Yes.
I would like to know.
Write us if they married billionaireses.
If your aunts are all billionaireses' aunts, we want to hear those stories.
So email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. If you like the show, if you like the BDE that we're putting into this episode, please support us on Patreon at patreon.com/omnibusproject. We have a fan group on Facebook. No one likes Facebook. I'm sure history will regard us as collaborationists.
Maybe this will be the week. Facebook's not having a great week. Maybe will remember.
Maybe this is it. If there were another alternative to Facebook in terms of a place to host a lively fan group of people that are already there sharing recipes or doing whatever else they do on Facebook. I went on there yesterday. I've been not looking at Facebook for weeks. I went on there yesterday and within 3 minutes found on Facebook somebody saying some stuff that made me mad, and I went on and left an excoriating comment.
Yeah.
That was like, "You know what? You know what? You're a dumb." I just let him have it with both barrels. Jeez,
did you actually say that?
And then I said it. I pushed send, and then I closed my computer and, you know, did that like, well, I showed him, and it was only 10 feet. I walked away, and 10 feet later, I was like, what am I doing? Don't go on Facebook.
I'm going to put some kind of plugin in your browser that lets you post things to Facebook that don't actually post.
Yeah.
So you feel good. You're like, yeah.
I told that guy.
Took care of that sucker.
Well, first of all, I should not be allowed to send emails at 1 o'clock in the morning. I shouldn't be allowed to send emails or communicate with other people. It should all be done by runner.
You know what I found out? That did you know this? Our friend Maria, her phone is in black and white. She makes her phone in black and white so she doesn't get too into it. Like she feels like the intoxicating candy color of your retina screen or whatever.
So she makes it black and white.
And it's true. I looked at her phone and it was like looking at a Kindle. I almost fell asleep And I told this to somebody else, and he was like, oh yeah, that's a thing I do on my phone as well. I set it to go to black and white every day at 10:30 or whatever.
Wow.
So just...
Okay.
Because it's like we've decided we can't live without our phones.
Right.
But what if we just like make them bad?
Wow. I like it.
Make them bad every day at 10:30.
I like it. A little bit of just, you know, just like, it's like what AT&T used to do. Slow our phones way down so they're not as good.
Nighttime used to be the time for phones.
Yeah. Nighttime Remember? Is it, the right time for phones.
It would get cheap. You could make.
Oh, yeah.
I can't call grandma until 9:30.
Yeah, the long distance rates go down. I forgot that. That's so charming.
What a weird memory hole. Yeah. Anyway. Facebook, by the way. Yeah, it's the Futurelings on Facebook. The only place you should go.
Yeah.
The rest of it is just for making your grandma into a white nationalist.
And the thing is, I do not go on Futurelings very often and write excoriating comments. I did a couple of times. If you recall, there were a couple of times when I took umbrage.
But we all remember the incidents.
That was years ago. Years ago. I haven't done it in a long time. Anyway, Facebook is a terrible thought crime, and in the future, we'll be judged for having a fan page there. But in the short term, the Futurelings page is delightful. Also, the Reddit page, Jizz, devoted to us, are wonderful, wonderful places.
Yeah, you just said there was no alternative, but there's Reddit.
There's Reddit, which I kind of, as much as I understand it, is not an alternative. It's only not as bad because it's not as concentrated.
What if instead of turning your grandma into a white nationalist, it just turned your teenagers into men's rights activists?
Right.
That's the choice you have nowadays.
So depending on which way you want to go, and also you can mail us actual things to our P.O. box, a relic of a different time, a relic of a time before you just went on the internet and ordered everything you want and it came right to your house.
I do feel like I'm walking into a sewing machine repair shop.
Yeah.
Every time I check my mail.
Why
does this exist still?
What was the last time you went into a typewriter repair shop? I mean, do you remember?
No, I've been to a vacuum cleaner repair shop.
Yeah.
And I've been to a sewing machine repair shop. I don't know if I've ever had to repair a typewriter.
Or
did you just walk in for fun?
No.
I used to ask if the restroom was public.
I used to go to typewriter repair shops, not all the time, but often enough. Because, you know, I would find an old typewriter and it would have this was when there were typewriters everywhere. And so it wasn't, it's not like, oh, I found another IBM Selectric in this room full of Selectrics, but I would find some interesting old typewriter and I would collect it, is the term of art. And then there would be some issue with it. It would be not calibrated. And I would take it to this little old guy that sat in a shop on the corner of like Olive and Boylston. He had a little corner and I would take it in there and it was dark in there and he had like an overhead light over his work and I would leave him my typewriter and I'd come. And I remember the day that closed and I was like, well, who's going to fix the typewriters? And the answer was no one.
We found out.
No one will fix the typewriters.
None of the typewriters are fixed anymore.
So mail us your things, your old typewriters, your granddad's old watches. What are the things that you are interested in?
Send me
pen sets.
Send me your grandpa's, Silver Age comic books.
Oh, that's what you want.
Stationery would be great.
Yeah, exactly. Love stationery.
Send me your old office supplies. Send me legal pads.
Heavy bond.
Half-used legal pads.
Paper, yeah.
I don't know.
Stamps. You know, stamps are a form of currency.
I just don't want to go through your dad's stuff. I feel creepy.
I really do.
It feels exploitative.
Does not feel that way to me. I will it's record.
It's why I don't watch Faces of Death.
Oh, right. Mm.
Like, you know, well, that's not the same, actually.
No more kittens are going to be killed because you watched Faces of Death.
I'm not squeamish. Like, I know people who literally backed out of a house they were closing on when they found out there'd been
somebody
suicide.
Died. Yeah.
And I that does not trouble me. I'll read your haunted Green Lantern comics.
Our P.O. Box is P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. Support the show with your generous financial contribution at patreon.com/omnibusproject. That's patreon.com/omnibusproject.
It does seem like I just wanted you to say it three times, I guess.
Patreon.com.
Patreon.
At.
The place to go to spend money on the feeling of having spent money on a thing. Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, could be our final word to you. But if providence allows, we hope to return to you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.